Good morning.
Thanks for that warm welcome back. I'm glad you didn't describe me like your folks. They're old, but they're active. I guess that's a compliment. And thanks to Deacon Zane and Pastor Lowell for taking up my slack in our absence. It's, again, just a blessing to know that there are men who, despite having already busy schedules, are still willing to add more work on top of that. That's a blessing that we have men here who are not only willing, but certainly able. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, but it's good to be home. Turn your Bibles to Psalm 127. We're going to start there in just a moment. I had a question that was given to me, a little while back, by a person who was asking how to deal with or relate to family members who aren't Christians. And in view of our upcoming session with Brother David Pickup, I thought it would be good to address that. I don't know if he's going to address these things specifically, but I'm hoping that it will be helpful considering the things that he's going to be talking with us about soon. You know, when you're converted to Christ, you can't help but be excited about that. You have a new destination that you're enthusiastic about. And you just suppose that everybody else in your family is going to be happy about that too. And maybe you talk unceasingly about your relationship with the Lord and about the joy that He brings you in spite of the difficulty that you might be going through. And you just, again, assume that they're going to want to listen to it. And then you find that they're not only not interested, but they may even be somewhat antagonistic toward the joy that you have because of Jesus. And that's tough. What do you do? I mean, we love our family, we love our kin, and we want to see them saved as well. And we also value the relationship that we have because of our blood that courses through each other's veins. We're close. And we wonder what to do now that there's an obvious strain in that relationship. And I'll tell you something, it's something that Cheryl and I have had our struggles with as well. So what do you do when you have relationship without fellowship? When you're related to somebody, but you don't have the same shared participation in spiritual work. Now there's no doubt that God places before us the ideal of family relationship. I ask you to turn to Psalm 127. Look there with me. In Psalm 127, begin in verse 1. He says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." Now there's lots of houses that we build, right? There's lots of shelters that we provide. And one of them is the family. It's the one that God established. But the verse tells us that unless God is not only involved, but at the head of the building of those relationships of that house or household, then it's going to be tough to maintain it the way that God intends it. He tells us in verse 3, "Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them." Now, we see in here that not only is there a blessing, right? He reminds us that children are a gift. And although they are a burden, first of all, they are a gift. But with that gift also comes responsibility, he tells us. They're like arrows, and arrows are meant to be aimed, right? Arrows are meant to hit their target. And so we recognize as parents that we want to work hard to try to make sure that we not only aim them correctly, but that the target itself is true and right that we aim them towards. Look at Psalm 128. In verse 1, the psalmist says, "How blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in His ways. When you shall eat of the fruit of your hands, you'll be happy, and it will be well with you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house, your children like olive plants around your table. Behold, for thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord." Now, obviously this is an ideal vision of what a family ought to be, right? A loving and providing father, a dutiful mother, great kids, all of whom understand their role or their place in the family. And he tells us here that this is for those, he says, who fears the Lord. In verse 1 and verse 4, it's for those who fear the Lord. Now, that means that God has something to do with this family, and that that family recognizes that our reverence towards God is the thing that makes this family work, in spite of the fact that we were reminded in this morning's Bible class that there is no such thing as a fully functional family. Every family is dysfunctional in some way. Every family goes through something that is a hiccup or a hindrance or a difficulty, right? But yet, for the family that fears the Lord, there is this ideal vision of what God wants for us, and we can work towards that vision. And fearing the Lord is the key to the whole thing. Look with me in Colossians chapter 3, make a hard right to the New Testament. Colossians chapter 3. This is one of those passages where the inspired apostle Paul tells us exactly what God requires from each person in the family. Everybody has a role to fulfill, and so he lets us know what that role is so that we can take our place in fulfilling it. He says in Colossians 3 and verse 18, "Wives, be subject to your husbands." Why? Because it's fitting in the Lord. "Husbands, love your wives. Do not be embittered against them. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. And fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they'll not lose heart." See, everybody in the Lord has a place, a role to assume. And God doesn't leave us without any indication about what that role is going to be. He wants us to know that there's a place for everybody in the family. And as long as everybody realizes that there's a responsibility, an obligation that they have to live up to, what a wonderful family that is. He reminds us that if we just love the Lord first, if we simply do what He says, then everybody's doing what they ought to in that family. And in this way, every family member is an asset, not only to the community, because they recognize responsibility and they want to contribute to the community, but to the family itself. Everybody's got a job. And we can look at this, and if everybody lived up to that ideal, we could just stop right there and say, everything's fine, right? But we know better. That's the ideal. The reality is usually something much, much different. Especially when a member of the family is not a Christian, or maybe was a Christian and has renounced that for some reason. Immediately, there's a conflict of agendas, of ideals, of worldviews, and of roles. And as Zane mentioned before, every family is dysfunctional in some way. Even families that understand their place in the Lord, there's still sometimes friction. But man, how much is that friction increased when there is somebody who is not pulling in the same way as the rest of that family? Jesus said that there would be difficulty. And he tells us over in Luke chapter 12, that they'll turn there, in some very frank terms about what that difficulty will be. Look with me in Luke chapter 12. Let's begin in verse 51. Jesus asks, "Do you suppose that I came to grant peace on earth? I tell you no, but rather division. For from now on, five members in one household will be divided, three against two and two against three. They'll be divided, father against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law." Now, of course, Jesus doesn't mean that, hey, I'm coming to bring trouble intentionally. What he's telling us is that, you know what, when there are some in the family who are for me and some who are against, well, naturally, there's going to be some division. Naturally, there's going to be conflict. And he says it's going to come from people that are closest to us. Notice what he says in verse 49. Look at verse 49. Jesus says, "I come to cast fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled." And that's exactly what Jesus did. He cast fire on the earth in a bunch of different ways. To his disciples, to those who love him, he casts the fire of enthusiasm. You've heard people say that they're on fire for the Lord, right? They love him and they are enthusiastic about what he requires of them so they can tell others what he wants from them. He came to cast the fire of controversy. And he did that every time he had some run-in with the religious hoity-toities of his day. He came to cast the fire of testing or division in what he talks about in the verses that we read just a moment ago. Go with me for a moment to Matthew chapter 10. Jesus says much the same thing, but he adds something to it there. I'll begin with me in verse 34. Matthew 10 and verse 34. Jesus is giving his disciples instructions for this limited preaching tour that they were about to assume. And he tells them again that there's going to be difficulty. In Matthew 10 and verse 34, Jesus says, "Don't think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I didn't come to bring peace, to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and daughter against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it." Now, Jesus isn't telling us literally that we should hate our family. He's using these words comparatively. He's not telling us to disdain family relationships, but he is saying, about as bluntly as he possibly could, that hostility is going to come, one, where we least expect, and two, where we least desire it, from those whom we love most, those who were closest to. And you think about it. When there is someone in the family who is obviously godly and trying to do the best, the truly converted wife will recoil in horror at the sin of her unconverted husband. The converted father will risk estrangement from his son for condoning his ungodliness. There are priorities we face, priorities that we must make, and they're not always easy to do. And sometimes for the Christian, this can be a source of not only heartbreak, but also distraction. Because sometimes, let's be frank, we prioritize our relationships over fellowship with God. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, go there with me. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In 1 Corinthians 7, in verse 32, the inspired apostle writes in the context of whether or not it's better to marry or not marry. What if there are conflicts? What if somebody doesn't believe? What if the two spouses are pulling in different directions? You know, all the things that people bring to a marriage, they're different. And so they bring all these differences to that marriage. And Paul is working in the context of that. And he says in verse 32, "I want you to be free from unconcern. One who's married is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is, or rather one who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife." Now, he's not necessarily saying that these things are sinful. I mean, after all, a spouse is concerned about how to please his wife, especially a newly married spouse, right? You've got this person now that you're with all the time, and you've got these interests that you're trying to make shared interests, but maybe they're not always, and you naturally want to please that person because you love them, you want to make your relationship together as ideal as possible. And Paul says, sometimes that can be a distraction. He says in verse 34, his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried, the virgin, is concerned about the things of the Lord. Why? Because she doesn't have a spouse to please, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. And this is the key, verse 35. Paul is saying, what I want to do is make sure that you understand what's appropriate, what's right in the Lord. That there are some things that will naturally be distracting to you. And sometimes those distractions, as I said before, can lead to heartbreak. If we let ourselves get too pulled into what those who don't love the Lord are trying to entice us with. Now, maybe they're not trying to pull you away from the Lord, but when you start to put more attention, affection, and focus on those things that are geared more towards pleasing a person rather than the Lord, then naturally, what Paul says is true. Your interests are divided. He says in verse 35, what I really want to do is promote what's appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. Let's consider for a moment the difference between what Christians would consider appropriate and what non-Christians would consider appropriate. The unsaved will consider it appropriate for you to compromise your spiritual convictions for the sake of that relationship. Why? Because they see it in the world all the time. They see compromise all the time. They see people willing to tolerate and condone all kinds of terrible things just for the sake of getting along. For the Christian who has already compromised their convictions, they have no problem with asking you to do the same. For the saved who fell away, they've already compromised, and so they don't think it's any big deal for you to just bend just a little bit, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more. But don't. There may come a time, when relationships must be severed because they can be destructive to spirituality. But long before you ever get to that place, hopefully you don't, inject godly positivity first. So let's talk about for a moment the response to the reality of possible divided interests. For the godly person, we want to know that there is a response that can be made. And it's going to be different depending on whether or not your loved one is a Christian or not. But there are some things that are similar to both of them. For instance, whether they're Christian or not a Christian, these are things I think that will be helpful to us as we embark on a mission to try to inject some godly, positive influence on that person. First, be prayerful. Pray for them. And tell them you're praying for them. And tell them why you're praying for them. I mean, even non-Christians like to be told, I'm praying for you. Because it's always a positive thing. So tell them. Be humble. Be willing to listen. We talked a lot about this morning in our Bible class. In fact, so much of what we talk about concerning our one another application that Zane has been leading us through in our morning Bible class is all about simply being humble, about being willing to listen. Don't berate that person because they have chosen an ungodly lifestyle. Certainly don't condone it. But don't try to beat them into submission, because I guarantee you, and I think Brother Pickup would say this as well, you can't force somebody into obeying the Lord. They'll make their own decision. Be loving with them and tell them you love them. I know that sometimes it can be difficult when they're pulling in a different direction, and because of their different direction, it's starting to fray at the edges of that relationship. Love them and tell them so. And finally, be patient with them. Be willing to work towards a better reconciliation, but also be willing to wait, because it may take a while. It may be a long, hard slog before you begin to see positive results from the work that you're trying to do with them. And if a family member is a non-Christian, there are some things that I think that we can do, and these may also apply to those who are Christians. First of all, one of the responses that we can do in the way that we work with them is to simply be agreeable. If you're still in 1 Corinthians 7, look at verse 12 with me. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 12. Paul says, now to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if a brother has a wife who's an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. Now, again, Paul says all this in the context of spouses trying to work out their differences in marriage when one is a believer and one's not a believer. Paul is saying here, there is some consent. And how do you arrive at consent? Well, by discussion, by talking things out, by realizing that at least for the time being, there may not be some things that are going to immediately be resolved, but there can be amicable cohabitation. There can be a way to live together. So talk, reason together as much as you can. And second, set a good example for them. In verse 14 of the same passage, Paul says, "For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they're holy." In verse 16, "For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife?" Now look first at verse 14. Paul doesn't mean that just because one member in the family is a Christian that suddenly the whole family are then Christians. What he is saying is that there is this positive influence in the family that makes your family different. And there are a whole lot of families in the world where there are no Christians in the household. And they're utterly different than your family is. But if there's at least one Christian in the household and they're trying to exert their godly influence on all the other members of that household, Paul says, that's a blessed family. They're already sanctified. They're already different than everyone else. And then he tells us why. Because you never know what will happen. You never know what will be the outcome of that. Look with me at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. In 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, Peter says, "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may, without a word, they may be won by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior." I know at least a couple of couples where the wife was a Christian, the husband was not. And for years, they lived together in this relationship. The relationship was close, it was loving, but it was not as complete as it could have been if the husband were only a Christian. And it went on for years and years until at some point, I'll speak specifically of one couple that I knew in Albuquerque. The husband would attend services with his wife, although he never obeyed the gospel. All those years, for decades, he attended services with his wife because that's what she did. And he loved her. And so he indulged her, were his words. He indulged her in going to church with her. But after years and years and years of listening to what was going on, it never escaped his mind that we're not as close as we could be if only we were pulling together. And he realized that she's never going to change. So it was up to him to make a decision. And guess what? One evening, he got up, he walked out of the pew, he came forward, and he put on Christ. And he did it sincerely, which was great because just about a year later, he was stricken with cancer and died. And you just never know. And he attributed all to the faithful, reliant, steadfastness of his wife. She never nagged him. She never cajoled him. She never berated him. But she simply showed by her steadfastness, by her good example, that godliness is better. And it finally got through. But a good example will only go so far sometimes. There comes a point where you just have to tell them the truth. In the little book of Jude, if you'll make a right with me, just before Revelation, the little book of Jude, in the little book of Jude, beginning in verse 22, Jude says, "Have mercy on some who were doubting. Save others, snatching them out of the fire, and on some have mercy with fear, hating even the garment polluted by the flesh." Now, First, he says, have mercy on some who were doubting. And there are some who doubt what they should do. So he says, be merciful. Show compassion. Like I said before, love them and tell them you love them. And then he says in verse 23, save others, snatching them out of the fire. There are some maybe who are obstinate, and you've got to be a little more forceful or bold in how you approach them. So be bold, he says. Be urgent in how you approach them. And then he says, on some have mercy with fear, hitting even the garment polluted by the flesh. Now there may be some in your family who hold great influence over you. Jude says, be aware of the risk of contamination, because their influence over you may cause you to be smoke smelly, as he puts it. But the point is that there is a way to approach everybody. And because everybody's different, you're going to have to use a different approach for everyone. Now, Christian family members may require a different approach. After all, they have heard the truth. They have obeyed the gospel. They have made a prior commitment to the Lord. So what you need to do is appeal to them based on their obligation to God. Over in Titus chapter 1, make a left with me. It's Titus chapter 1. In Titus 1 and in verse 13, Paul talks about those who were Cretans, and those who lived on the Isle of Crete had a reputation for living unsavory lives. They were called gluttons, he says, and Paul says, it's true. That's the reputation they got is well deserved. He says, for this reason, reprove them severely that they may be sound in the faith. Now stop there for a moment. Paul is saying there are some Christians who live on the Isle of Crete who have been involved in this persistent reputation, this bad rep that the Cretans had. And so he says, because they're living expectantly to that reputation, he says, reprove them. That's not the way Christians live. Reprove them so that they'll be sound in the faith. Now, reproof is difficult because it means to confront someone with the truth. It means to confront someone not only with the error of what they're doing, but with the positive solution to how it can be made better. And nobody likes confrontation. Nobody likes to tell somebody what they're doing wrong. He says in verse 16, they profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny Him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. Wow. Paul lays it on the line, doesn't he, to Titus? Those are strong words. And yet we find that sometimes with family members who were Christians and then have fallen away. They think somehow that they still have this relationship with the Lord and everything's okay. And although they make a profession of faith, they make a profession of being Christians, Paul says their deeds deny them. They're not living in a way that's consistent with who they say they are. And he doesn't mince words about the example or maybe the warning that they exude to other people. And sometimes when we have this obligation to come to those whom we love, those whom we're closest to, and we have to tell them that they're wrong, we want to be tactful sometimes. We want to be nice. So much so that sometimes the urgency and the importance of the message is lost in the niceness. We should understand that for a Christian, sin in a Christian's life is not some minor infraction. Sin in a Christian's life condemns that soul to hell. And some just need to be shaken up with the truth. Paul said in Galatians 4 verse 16, have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? Well, of course not. Paul reminds them that his aim was at reconciliation. And that's what we want to do to those family members who are living the wrong kind of life, although they know better than that. We want to remind them that it's not about condemning you to hell. It's about pointing you towards reconciliation, first to the Lord, and also to you, Because when they're right with the Lord, their relationship with you will begin its path of healing. The aim is not further estrangement. The aim is not further conflict. The aim is always loving reconciliation. Let's talk for a moment about those family members who have been withdrawn from. This is a difficult area. And I don't claim to know the application of how we should deal with family members who have been withdrawn from perfectly. I think I can offer some suggestions about how we can deal with that, but it's a sticky situation. What do we do with a Christian family member who has fallen away and because of their obstinate refusal to repent has been withdrawn from by the local church? Well, on the one hand, Christian family members still have a responsibility to one another. There's still an obligation to certain duties that they share together, right? Dad still has to provide for the family. Mothers still have their duties to respond to or to perform in the family. And I get that. I get that there are still familial responsibilities that have to be worked out. But I think there is something that can send a powerful message. And that's simply by, in spite of the fact that you've got to still, if you're in the same household, work with each other in such a way that the household still works. It's not to do anything that makes them think that their pathway is okay. Look over at 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians 5, this is a familiar passage in which Paul talks about a procedure for working with a sinful member of the congregation in Corinth. In 1 Corinthians 5, as you're well aware, he talks about the sin of this church member in verse 1, and then spends the rest of what we know of as chapter 5, just blasting the congregation for not doing something about it. They had a responsibility to this member because he was a member of the family. It was a spiritual family, but they still had responsibility to him. And Paul says in verse 11, he says, I'm not talking about those who were not Christians, those people who you have interaction with out in the world. He says in verse 11, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he's an immoral person or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one. Now, Paul calls for some very drastic measures for the one who is obstinate in sin. And it may be that there will come a time when you're at your wit's end. It's obvious that there will be no repentance by this person and that the estrangement is inevitable. That's a difficult, hard place to come to, especially with a family member, someone whom you love. But Paul is saying you do this so that they know that there is no real relationship without first being right with the Lord. And that's a tough lesson, not only to learn, but to implement. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, go there with me. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, again, Paul is speaking in the context of local church discipline, but there's I think a lesson here that will be helpful. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and in verse 6, Paul says, Now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep away from every brother who leads an unruly life, and not according to the tradition which you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example, because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you. Now, Paul is talking about the fact that there is a right way to walk. And the words he uses, as far as like the word unruly there in verse 6, it's got to do with a soldier who is out of step. And that's what happens when a family member leaves the Lord. They're walking out of step. They're not going in the same direction or even in the same pathway as the rest of the family. And Paul says sometimes that there comes a time when not only that relationship is not what it should be, but because it's not what it should be, it needs to be obvious to that sinning family member that it's not what it should be. He says in verse 15, Yet do not regard him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. Listen. Your actions will speak louder than words. We can say all the right things, but if our actions don't show that we're serious, then the message is conflicting. And I get it. I get it. It's hard. It's difficult because this is someone you love. But I'll tell you, coddling a family member in sin does no one any good. And if we value their soul, then they must see that we're not going to give them any indication that what they're doing is acceptable to the family or to the Lord. Now, we want peace. I get that. We want peace. But peace at all costs? No. No. Dealing with loved ones who are floundering morally is upsetting. It hurts the whole family. But the Bible urges us, I believe, to be strong, to be resolute, to have a plan to deal with it. And most of all, to be faithful ourselves to the Lord. And again, I think these are good keys to begin with, to be prayerful, to be humble, to be loving, and to be patient. Because there are few things that are more difficult than relationship without fellowship. But don't give up hope. Don't give up hope in them or in the Lord. Please take your songbooks out. We're going to stand in a few moments and we're going to sing the song that Dean has selected for us. It's a song that reminds us to be hopeful. We're forward-looking people. We should be forward-looking in our relationships. We should be forward-looking in our faith. And maybe there's someone here this morning who is mired too much in the here and now. You're missing out. You're missing out on what God has for you. The best way for a family to be a real family is for everyone to pull in the same direction. And that direction is upward. And if there's some way this morning that we can help someone in that struggle, we want you. We're your family. We love you. And we want to help. But you need to let us know. Will you? Come now while we stand and sing.